Hello, and welcome to our very last episode of the season for Pod Parks. We are recording live from Adelaide, Australia, where we're currently holding our Global Parks Congress in collaboration with Parks and Leisure Australia and Green Adelaide. We've had a fantastic couple of conference days with, honestly, some of the best conversations and dialogues in the parks world. And we've had technical tours that have taken us all across the region, and of course, plenty of reflections about the past, present, and future of our communities, our cities, and the world of parks. And what a better way to end the season and to commemorate the conference than to share our very first keynote speech that was delivered by Professor Chris Daniels, Chair of Green Adelaide and Professor of Biology at the University of South Australia. Chris has been an important researcher and science communicator in the Australian conservation community, and he's now working to lead Adelaide in its quest to embody being a national park city. So without further ado, and for the last time this season, I'm Alice Landon, and this is Pod Parks.
Pod Parks, a podcast for the park-minded. Brought to you by World Urban Parks.
As you've already heard, I'm a scientist, I'm a biological scientist, which means, like most biological scientists, I'm a miserable old coot, because we get to look at all that is happening to nature around the world and its spectacular decline. So I thought I'd start this with the end of the world in four slides. This is the first. We're in the middle of a massive, spectacular, exponential increase in world's population. So when I was born in 1960, there were just on 3 billion people on the planet. When my father was born in 1932, there was just over 2 billion people on the planet. So since 1960, we have seen that grow from 3 billion to 8 billion, almost a threefold increase, plus the addition of another 5 billion people on the planet. And that causes enormous pressure on the resources for this planet and on the space and opportunity and habitat available for other wildlife. So in conjunction with this huge increase in human population, we've had a massive species loss. And you can see that that is exponential as well there when you look at the green line, and it is continuing. But it's not just the loss of species that we need to worry about. The second slide is the decline in the number of individuals of most of the important keynote species. World Wildlife Fund did this study back starting in 1970, where they monitored 4,000 populations of animals that had at least 20,000 representatives in herds. So we're talking about wildebeest, we're talking about elephants and deer and so forth there. And they monitored the number in each of these populations and noted that between 1970 and 2016, the number of individuals in these populations had declined by an average of 68%. So what that means is, back in 1970, when there were 20,000 animals, now that will have dropped down to, what is it, about 8,000 animals. If you start with 8,000, that's now down to 3,000. If it's 3,000, you're now down to 100 or so. So we have this huge number of species out there that are down to very small and potentially unviable populations. And this is called the extinction cliff. So not only are the species disappearing or have disappeared, but a huge number are approaching extinction as well. Thirdly, of course, it doesn't mean that the planet is empty of meat. What we are seeing is a massive increase in the kilograms of mammals that walk the planet. And that is primarily us and our domestic animals. So back about 10,000 years before the current era, you will see that all of life was effectively wild animals, the purple bars. So about, whatever that is, about 30 million tons of meat roamed the earth. By the time we get to 2000, the year 2000, that had fallen to only a tiny proportion of the mass of meat on the planet. We've seen the rise of domestic animals, By the time we get to 2025, thereabouts, we are seeing a huge increase in the mass of domestic animals on the planet. And the one next to it, the distribution of mammals on Earth, shows you that only about 4% of mammals on the planet are wild. The rest of the mass is made up of us, and particularly cattle, other sheep and pigs, horses and other domestic animals. So we've got this massive load of resource-using mammals on the planet that then lead to desertification, habitat loss and so forth. So we've got this incredible compression that the world is facing. And then the fourth one is the rise of cities. So what we have seen over the last 150 years is the movement of people away from rural lifestyles into the cities. Now about 50% of the world's population live in cities, and it's increasing up towards 90%. We now have cities that are well over 30 million people on all of the continents except Australia, and this will only continue here. So we are already an urban community, and that's important for two reasons. One is that we tend to put our cities on the very best possible land. This is the location usually associated with coastal rivers, which provide the best quality soils, the regularity of water, and so has very high biodiversity. And the second thing is, this is where people are, so this is where people make their connection with nature. They have their first experiences and they develop their own bonding with nature. So cities are incredibly important then in how we respond to the biodiversity crisis. So what happened in Australia? Australia has been separated from the rest of the world for more than 50 million years and has its own extraordinary flora and fauna. There's some 24,000 species of native plants found here in Australia, and a huge proportion of them are endemic, which means they're found nowhere else in the world, about 91.3%. And that's particularly within the flowering plants. So as you move around Adelaide, check out the extraordinary, unusual floral flora that we have here. We have Baxias and Corias. We have about 600 species of flowering gum tree here. And most of them are flowering at the moment. We also have the wattles and a lot of small and medium-sized flowering plants that are quite spectacular. So it's an opportunity to enjoy plants that you can see nowhere else in the world. And then with that comes our own endemic fauna. So more than 6,000 vertebrate species occupy Australia, some 378 mammals, almost 900 birds, 5,000 fish, and huge numbers of reptiles, amphibians, and more than 100,000 invertebrates, insects, crustaceans, millipedes, centipedes, those sorts of things, spiders, have been identified here. More than 93% of the reptiles, 94% of amphibians, 46% of birds, and 70% of mammals are endemic to the area. We have marsupials, we have these magnificent animals that carry their young in pouches, and some of you would have seen them at Clearland and elsewhere. And these are really quite extraordinary animals. One thing you should note is the mixture here between the endemic plants and particularly the birds. Adelaide, South Australia, Australia is a noisy place. We have lots and lots of birds that will squawk, carry on, and make enormous amounts of racket. And this is very different to many of the forests in the rest of the world, which are relatively silent. So as you go about, listen to the noise. Appreciate that, yeah, we've got an extraordinary array of plants and animals. But what do we do to it? Well, we did a huge amount of damage to this area. If you look at the number of species here of flora and of the various vertebrate species, you'll see that a very large number in absolute terms and a very significant proportion in terms of percentages are in either conservation management or now classified as vulnerable or threatened or critically endangered or even extinct. So we've done pretty much what everywhere else in the world has done, except in some ways we've done it better than most, and that is to really bring about a massive decline in our animals. So what's happened here in Adelaide? Adelaide's actually an extraordinary place. It is a biodiversity hotspot. And that is a location which has a disproportionate number of species for the size of the area. And Adelaide is one of only 15 biodiversity hotspots in Australia. And Adelaide is that because of its unusual geography. If you look at Adelaide, it's this strange slice of pie shaped property. It is essentially a flat plain called the Adelaide Plains that is bordered by the westerly face of the Mount Lofty Ranges on one side and Gulf St Vincent on the other. And this little wedge of land enables different ecosystems to occur because of the way water flows. So we get our rainfall mostly in the winter time from southeasterlies that come off the cold waters of Gulf St Vincent, move across the plain, are pushed up the westerly face of the Mount Lofties, and the rainfall falls up in the upper reaches of the Mount Lofties. And these move down onto the plain through a system of 9 separate catchments. Some of them are quite large, like the Torrens and Onkaparinga. Others are quite small, like Sturt River. But these catchments carried the water onto the plain, where they stopped behind the line of sand dunes, and most of the water drained into the aquifers. What these separate catchments did was create a set of different environments depending on where the catchments were located in the plain. Because the Mount Lofties come off at 45 degrees, you've got this big wedge of open space to the north, and you've got very small areas down towards the south where the Mount Lofties come towards the coast. And so what we get, therefore, is differential rainfall across Adelaide. So we can have a 3- to 4-fold variation in rainfall from coast to mountains, particularly in the northern areas where the mountains are a lot further away from the coast. And this, in association with different soil types, we have reactive clay soils, we have sand soils, all sponsors different little micro-ecological units. So each of these little ecosystems were completely different, and they varied from reeds to open woodlands to samphire swamps, calyptus pine, and so forth. And each of these enabled an incredible collection of animals to exist, and often they were quite different, but separated by only a kilometre or two. So because we had these 6 or 7 significant ecosystems, we wound up with some 30% of the state's plants, more than 60% of the state's birds, and about 25 to 30% of the state's reptiles, mammals, amphibians and fish, all in an area that's a tiny fraction of 1% of the area of the state. If we could have set up one national park in South Australia, don't worry about any of the other ones, just one to best conserve and reflect the biodiversity of the area, the location would have been Adelaide. But we didn't do this. This was a colony established in 1836 under an act developed by Edward Gibbon Wakefield. He and a group of others developed the South Australian Company with the idea of establishing Adelaide here. And they sold land, people came out here, and they could occupy the plains because it was easy to clear. It had these wide swathes of grasslands, isolated areas with individual trees that were easy to chop down and clear. So most of these ecological areas were destroyed. Less than 10% of the area of the Mount Lofty Ranges is now remnant forests. Less than 5% is open space here in the city of Adelaide. And much of our remnant vegetation is actually grey box mangrove that you can see at St Kilda's. So we did, in fact, remove many of these fabulous ecosystems. But that doesn't mean we don't have life here. And in fact, the number of species in the area have increased tremendously. And that's because we introduced all sorts of things. So there's about 1,500 native species of plants located in our area. And we've added to that about 1,500 introduced plants. And then, of course, there's a large number of animal species that were introduced either deliberately or accidentally over the last 200 years since colonisation. And so you can get a picture of what happens in a location by looking at Adelaide since 1836. And it's a great blueprint for how cities change the nature of the area. In 1836, there were, as I've said, about 1,500 plant species. We brought with us a huge number of plants, as some of those were important agricultural plants, and in fact the Botanic Gardens was established as a place initially for testing plants and see what would survive well in Adelaide's climate. We also have arboretums, the Waite Arboretum and the Botanic Park, which was also a test place for trees and for trialling trees. So they were brought out to provide food, to provide shade and shelter, to provide garden plants, and of course to reflect the cultures of the people who had arrived here. So we brought out poplars and oak and elm and a whole array of different plants that were very popular in Europe, because we were very much a European society that was homesick, so wanted to bring out their specific plants. This has a significant effect on the native species. So Darrell Cranbull, a very famous botanist from the department here, produced a book in 1996 documenting the plants that were on the Adelaide Plains and recorded the disappearance of some 100 species in that volume. But in the end, the natives start to get squeezed out by the introduction of others. So you get this classic increase exponentially at first of biodiversity from the plants being introduced, that then plateaus off, and then you get the disappearance of natives. And this has a profound effect on bird species. So what we also did here is introduce birds from Europe. As you're travelling around, you should see blackbirds, starlings, sparrows, skylarks, chaffinches, goldfinches, quite an array of birds that were deliberately introduced by the South Australian Acclimatisation Society. And this was a group of leaders that were established in the 1870s to deliberately introduce European birds in particular to the area to make Adelaide sound more like Europe. They didn't like the cacophony from the honey eaters and from the kookaburras and from the magpies. They missed the warbling sounds of home. So they brought out these birds and released them. They released rabbits. And in fact, in the 1870s, we had a law that protected rabbits from hunting. It's hard to believe, really, isn't it? They also got a bit carried away and introduced ferrets, squirrels. One person tried to introduce bear, but fortunately, most of those didn't take. So what else has happened here in Adelaide? Adelaide's a really interesting city because it's really a garden city. It actually started off with access to this giant flat plain, so much of that was around agriculture and the ease of setting up small farms. As the city grew, the farms disappeared, the little hamlets like Mitcham and Salisbury started to become incorporated into the greater Adelaide sprawl. And traditionally, Adelaide is a low-density city. It was initially small houses on large blocks, often they're referred to as the quarter acre, that then moved to the sixth of an acre and now much smaller. And it extends really some 90 to 100 kilometres north to south, and at its widest point, it's about 40 kilometres. And classically, it had this access to space, and this has been progressively disappearing, as it has in cities around the world, because of increased densification. And you can see what effect this is going to have on biodiversity. So here's a suburb that is near here, up in the hills here. On the right, beyond, is an area of traditional Adelaide development. So you would have a large block, small to medium-sized house, big backyard, and also a significant front yard. The backyard was often the home for things like a veggie patch, for fruit trees. It would have an old rainwater tank there for collecting local water. Invariably have a hills hoist and a path that acted as a cricket pitch in the summer, a big piece of lawn for mucking around with. There's a very large array of trees introduced to natives that provided really important habitat for birds, for butterflies, for possums and for those sorts of animals. This is gradually replaced by much smaller blocks. Some of our blocks now are down to about 200 square metres. These blocks are often containing very large houses, so there's very little open space, very little room for trees or plants. And so you can see that the disappearance of nature from the backyards here. So these suburbs are hotter in the summer, they're colder in the winter, and they have a much greater amount of runoff, of rain runoff, so much less sustainable. And of course, they're totally uncluttered with wildlife. So we're developing now, unfortunately, a city that is at risk of losing a lot of its natural heritage as we continue to grow. Accompanying this is the growing fear of the environment itself, that nature is bad, nature is a challenge, and nature is out to get you. For those of you who've arrived in Australia for the first time, I bet you've heard plenty of stories about arriving here, and if you've got to be careful of the spiders don't get you, the snakes will, if the snakes don't get you, well, go swimming in the ocean and the white pointers will get you. Don't get me started on jellyfish, the blue ringed octopus and all the rest of it. And if you put in nature in your yard, then you will be filled with brown snakes that exist solely to eat your children and rip your face off. And so we have all of these stories going around about the disaster of nature. Add to that bushfires, the risks of trees falling on your house, and there's a lot of stories then promulgated about why we should not have nature within our communities. In addition, there's quite a number of studies that show that people are also frightened of nature, and in particular, they're frightened of things with lots of legs. Apparently legs are a bad thing, especially with invertebrates, because they give people the heebie-jeebies. People are frightened of spiders, and Australia has a reputation for too many spiders. And of course, you've arrived in swooping season. We're right in the middle of magpie season. These are magnificent birds that are really thriving in the city, but in springtime, a very small proportion, about 2% of pairs of magpies will swoop. It's always the male, and the male has often learnt to hate particularly cyclists. They've often learnt that behaviour from their parents. So sometime in the distant past, the heritage of a particular magpie family has been disturbed by a person and they've passed that down. So Dad therefore swoops on anyone who comes in the territory just over that breeding period of 6 weeks, from really September to November. So you do have to be cautious about magpies. And so these all then tend to put about that urban nature is bad. And of course that nature itself isn't always popular with everyone who spends time outdoors. And so our response to these sorts of emotions is to exclude nature from the urban environment. And we are building more and more communities that are relatively without trees. The one at the bottom left there is actually Aldinga, and that was built and then advertised as a sustainable community because you didn't need to water anything. And this has been highlighted by this piece of art called The Last Tree in Racina. Some of you may have seen that. It's actually a conglomeration of pictures, but it's designed to emphasise the growing cities that are there without nature. And building these small blocks with large houses, continuing urban sprawl over quality land, also changes in recreational practice by children, particularly the move towards electronic apparatus and staying inside, spending more time on your phone, rather than going outside, is becoming a real challenge. And this leads to many developments in unsustainable practice. This also influences the way we think about our open spaces. So we've got this tension between, do we go for the stark and apparently safe, or do we go for the more natural and more relevant to the environment of the area? The other big worry we have is what this means to the understanding of nature in our next generations. We know that we face all of these strong issues about how we deal with the coming environmental apocalypse, and we need people really well-versed in the situation. If their backyard is more like the last tree in Racina, then they're not going to have a strong appreciation of the importance of nature. Edward O. Wilson and Stephen Keller produced an outstanding book called The Biophilia Hypothesis, which shows how much we actually need nature for our own health and well-being. And Richard Louv wrote a book that I'm sure many of you read, Last Child in the Woods. If you want to ruin a week, I suggest you read that book. It's incredibly depressing, where he has highlighted the development of generations of children who've never really spent time outside, who've never climbed a tree, never mucked around in a creek, never spent any time enjoying nature. And that, of course, the Spark Nature Play and other organisations around the world to reconnect children and families with nature.
And yet we know that biodiversity has enormous benefits and that it is incredibly important to the well-being of communities. We know that biodiversity is integral to maintaining the stability of ecosystems. And that's particularly important because of the necessary ecosystem services that nature provides. So nature gives us excellent soils, it gives us fresh water and clean air. All of that is driven by biodiversity. Without it, we really run into trouble with our ecosystem services. Nature also provides resilience and the ability to deal with the challenges that we're starting to face around climate change. The greater and more interactive biodiversity is, the greater is the ability for a system to recover from flood, from drought, from fire, from sea incursions, and all sorts of other challenges. Nature also provides us with our agricultural food, with our medicines, and it's incredibly important economically. So through ecotourism and a whole range of different activities, nature actually contributes to the economic well-being of a community. So we must have biodiversity. It also delivers a wide range of other functions for community. And we've really seen this with the response to COVID when we're locked into our place. The importance of having green spaces to go to. We know that it's important for physical well-being and for exercise. Even more importantly, it's important for mental health and well-being, particularly for kids, for dealing with anxiety and depression. Spending time outdoors is really important. And these physical health benefits have led to the rise of nature play, healthy parks, healthy people, nature prescriptions, and a whole range of other approaches. But nature does something even more important. It creates a sense of place. So we are who we are as Adelaideans, as South Australians, as Australians, because of the nature we surround ourselves with. And sense of place is that connection with a community that makes us value it. You can often tell if you've got a strong sense of place because you get homesick when you go somewhere else. And a lack of sense of place is referred to as placelessness, which means you don't care about where you are. So if you don't give a damn, well, you're not going to look after it. And so placelessness leads to a rise in things like petty crime, gangs, graffiti, property damage, those sorts of activities. So it's incredibly important to have a sense of place, and nature gives us that. And you can tell that you have a strong sense of place if you become strongly connected to things like the sounds of magpies, the feel of the sand under your feet if you like to walk on the beach, the smell of eucalypt on a hot day. I can give an even better example of sense of place by talking about spiders. But huntsmen are a really significant part of ours. And I've brought along one here. This is Harry the Huntsman. Okay, gives you a good idea about the size of huntsmen. Now, already some people are starting to smile here because South Australians and Australians generally have quite a lot of experience with huntsmen. You often find it under the visor of your car and your letterbox. And there's always someone in the family whose job it is to get rid of the spider, right? It's not always dad, sometimes it's mum, sometimes it's a kid. And of course, Australians have a patented way of getting rid of spiders. Yeah, get a cup, piece of paper, take it outside, right? You get the idea for the sense of place, and that's what nature does. It gives us these shared stories and these shared connections that make us proud to be who we are. So this brings us then towards the end of my presentation, which is about why we have Green Adelaide. We have all of these challenges. We have a world challenge, we have a national challenge, we have a local challenge. And we have a challenge around how we are building our communities and how we are preparing our generations for the coming challenges that they face. So in 2020, the government brought in, in fact the Act was 2019, the Landscape Act was introduced, which really focused on the best use of natural resources across the state. Within the Landscape Act was Green Adelaide. And this was an opportunity to create the only natural resources management board that is solely within a city. So here we are focused on how we best use, we have seven priorities, best use seven categories of the natural landscape for the betterment of community and for the betterment of biodiversity. So Green Adelaide's been in operation now for, just over 3 years, and our vision is to create a cooler, greener, wilder, climate-resilient Adelaide that also connects with the variation in cultures that exist here, from Kaurna people who've been here for at least 40,000, if not 60,000 years, to those that have arrived here last Tuesday. And Green Adelaide really is determined to make a difference around seven priorities. So we examine the metropolitan coast. We look at waterways and water bodies here. We look at streets and open spaces, parklands, the green areas. We have water sensitive and biodiversity sensitive urban design. We manage pest, plants and animals. We support our local biodiversity and we have nature education. And we take these seven priorities and we do them working with partners to deliver in a number of really important areas. And all of this is designed to increase the quality of nature and people's connection to it. And that then leads us to National Park City, and we're incredibly thrilled with National Park City. We were the second city declared in December 2021 through a really exhaustive process, and you'll hear much more about that process at the moment. National Park City is all of these things that I've just been outlining. It's all about the way we embrace local nature, we connect the built environment with nature, and we connect people with nature. So we learn to live in, on, and with nature within the urban context. And National Park City is our way of really explaining what we do and why we do it. It helps support us in our ambitions. So one of our ambitions is to bring back platypus to the River Torrens, Karawira Parry. And this was an animal that was here till 1880s. We exterminated it, mostly by turning the river into the condition of the black and white photograph there. We have, over the last 30 years, been working really hard to recover the River Torrens. It has now been determined by independent authorities that the river is in condition good enough to host platypus. So our big aim is now to bring those animals back. And it also is a way of expressing and understanding our challenges. So in conclusion, sustainable activities are not significant without a biodiversity component. We cannot have sustainable communities unless we embrace the need for biodiversity. And that the environment is a driver for social change. We do know from all of these local events that there still is enormous upheaval, and traditionally social change has been driven by pestilence, by plague, by war, by religious upheavals, and so forth. Now it's the environment through climate change that's bringing about the challenges that we face. And we need to meet them by addressing the issues within our communities, the way we build and maintain our cities. This picture here is the city of Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. And it's pretty much how we imagine cities to be. Dry, dusty, completely treeless, not a very nice place to live. That's a very unfair picture of Riyadh, because that's the larger picture. I'd actually just taken the top bit there. Here, the Saudi Arabian authorities have used their own wastewater to create a large lake in the middle. They use recycled water to plant up their streets and their local parks. They use the streets as a greenway and access into the city, and so have transformed the nature of their cities. And so with that image, I will thank you very much for coming along. That's your challenge, that's our challenge, that's all of our challenge. Thank you very much.
This marks the end of today's episode, but never, ever, ever the end of the conversation. Now, as I said earlier, today is our very last episode of our second season of Pod Parks. And I don't actually think you understand how excited that makes me. We've recorded 30 episodes of our podcast. We've talked to people from all over the world, and we've started to build a community of park lovers from all walks of life that are curious and committed to learn more about the world of parks. So whether you've been with us from the very beginning, or you've just discovered this after this last week in Adelaide, I want to thank you for joining us in this never-ending exploration of green spaces. Pod Parks is what it is thanks to you, so thank you. And with that being said, we'll be taking a short hiatus the next couple of weeks to really reflect on how far we've come and to work on a better and bigger season 3. And we really value your opinion, so please write us a review in whatever platform you listen to us in, or shoot us a message at research@worldurbanparks.org with any comments or suggestions you might have for next season. And in the meantime, please continue to enjoy this season's episodes, tune in to those you might have missed maybe, and keep interacting with fellow park enthusiasts around you. I'm sure we can grow our community so that every single person in the world is a champion for parks. And before we leave, I want to, of course, invite you to become a member at worldurbanparks.org. Join that growing community of park professionals. And I have to end with a call to action, right? So go out, explore your nearest park, bask in the presence of nature, and we'll see you again very, very soon. Bye.
PodParks is written and hosted by Alice Landon, produced by Victoria Martin and Luis Romano. Sound engineering by Vladimir Yanis. Don't forget to visit worldurbanparks.org and explore the resources our community has for you. Get out, explore, connect.